Welcome to HN Pod, your daily download of the top stories from Hacker News. Today is Wednesday, October 8th, 2025, and this is episode number 178.
We've got a great lineup today. First up, a major reversal from Synology after a customer revolt. Then, we'll dive into a fascinating bug hunt by the team at Cloudflare in the Go compiler.
After that, a cautionary tale about a vendor who might have been reading their clients' emails. And we'll look at how a one-man campaign is causing major problems for the EU's controversial chat control bill.
And finally, we'll wrap up with some exciting science. The winners of the 2025 Nobel Prize in Chemistry have been announced.
Let's get right into it. The top story today, with nearly 1,000 points, is about Synology. They've reversed their deeply unpopular policy of banning third-party hard drives in their newer NAS devices.
This is a huge deal for anyone in the home lab or small business space. Earlier this year, Synology decided that for their new 2025 models, you could only use their own, much more expensive Synology-branded hard drives. If you tried to use a standard drive from Western Digital or Seagate, you'd get warnings and some features wouldn't work.
And the community was, to put it mildly, not happy. People buy Synology for the software and the flexibility. Forcing them into a hardware ecosystem they didn't want felt like a massive betrayal. The article from Guru3D reports that NAS sales plummeted as a result. People just stopped upgrading.
It was a classic case of a company getting too big for its britches and completely misreading its customer base. They saw their competitor QNAP have some security issues and probably thought, hey, we're the market leader. Our users have nowhere else to go. Let's squeeze them for more money.
But they were wrong. And now, with the latest DSM 7.3 update, they've quietly walked it all back. Third-party drives are welcome again. But the comments on Hacker News really dig into the lasting damage. This isn't just about a policy, it's about trust.
Exactly. A commenter named Jacques M. made a fantastic point. Trust is everything in the storage business. This is the hardware that holds people's precious data. Once you show that you're willing to make user-hostile decisions for profit, it's very hard to win that trust back. He said he's been a loyal customer for years, but won't be giving them another cent.
And it's not just the external perception. User Azavertsen talks about the internal morale hit. You have to imagine the engineers and support staff at Synology knew this was a terrible idea. They probably fought against it and were overruled by management. That feeling of being ignored just kills the culture that made the company great in the first place.
There's this incredible anecdote from a user named Orornis, who worked at a different company where the technical leadership developed a similar kind of arrogance. He remembers the CEO literally bragging in a meeting, saying something like, "Can you believe that? They'll buy anything we tell them to." And of course, the backlash eventually came for them too.
So while it's great that Synology reversed the policy, the scar tissue is there. They've shown their hand, and a lot of their most loyal technical users are now looking at alternatives or thinking about building their own NAS. A real self-inflicted wound.
Absolutely. A cautionary tale for any company with a dedicated user base.
Next up, we have a deep dive technical post from Cloudflare titled, "How We Found a Bug in Go's ARM64 Compiler." These are always a treat.
They really are. Cloudflare operates at such a massive scale that they encounter bugs that almost no one else would ever see. In this case, their services running on ARM64 servers were experiencing very rare, sporadic crashes. The error was a fatal error traced back did not unwind completely, which points to some kind of stack corruption.
The blog post walks through their entire debugging process. At first, they thought it was related to some old code that used panic/recover for error handling. They removed that, and the crashes seemed to stop for a bit, but then they came back even worse.
The real breakthrough came when they noticed a pattern. The crashes were always happening during garbage collection, while the Go runtime was trying to unwind a Go routine stack. And every single time, it was happening when a specific function from a networking library was preempted, interrupted by the scheduler.
And the root cause is just fascinating. It turns out that for very large stack allocations, the Go compiler on ARM64 was generating code that adjusted the stack pointer in two separate instructions instead of one atomic operation.
Right. So imagine the program needs to make space on the stack, say 100 kilobytes. The compiler would issue one instruction to add 64 kilobytes, and then a second instruction to add the remaining 36. The bug was that the Go runtime could interrupt the program right between those two instructions.
So the garbage collector would wake up, look at the stack, and see it in a completely inconsistent state, partially adjusted, and then everything would crash. It's a race condition baked right into the compiler's output.
The comments on HN are full of appreciation for this kind of detective work. People are geeking out about the specifics of ARM assembly and the stack moves once rule. One person linked directly to the commit in the Go source code that fixes it, which is essentially to use a temporary register to calculate the full value and then apply it to the stack pointer in a single instruction.
It's just a perfect example of why scale matters. A bug this subtle, a race condition that depends on an asynchronous preemption happening between two specific assembly instructions in a function with a large stack frame, you or I would probably never find that. But when you're Cloudflare, running this code on thousands of machines, the one in a billion chance happens every day.
And it's great marketing for their engineering team. If you can solve this, you can probably solve my company's problems.
Okay, let's move on to our next story, which is a bit of a horror story. It's from a blog called IT Notes, titled "The Email They Shouldn't Have Read."
This is a wild one. An IT consultant tells the story of helping two public agencies move away from a very expensive, managed open source email provider to a self-hosted solution. He set everything up, and the agencies were ready to save a ton of money and own their own data.
But things went south fast. The day they were supposed to give their notice to the old provider, the provider called them. They somehow knew everything, that the agencies were planning to leave, the specific details of the new setup, and they even had a copy of the confidential quote the consultant had prepared.
The provider then used this information to threaten them with legal action and pointed to obscure clauses in their contract that essentially locked them in for another 5 years. The consultant was stunned. How could they possibly know all of this?
They set a trap. They had a friend send a fake quote from a non-EU company to one of the agencies. The next day, the provider called and warned them about the compliance risks of working with non-EU companies. The implication was unavoidable. They were reading their customers' emails.
And when confronted, the provider's response was chilling. Something to the effect of, "I'm not saying we do, but we could. It's in the contract. You should read the fine print from the amendment 2 years ago." They had buried the right to access customer data, for security reasons, in a contract update.
The comment section really broadens this out. One user says it sounds like Oracle, which has become shorthand in the tech world for this kind of predatory vendor behavior. Another user, This Is It, shares a story about a director at their own company who constantly ignores compliance and security rules, dismissing everything as harmless, making it impossible to guard against these kinds of threats.
And there's a whole discussion about why stories like this are always anonymized. People want to name and shame, but the author can't because the company is so litigious. It creates this culture of fear that allows these bad actors to keep operating because nobody can afford to call them out publicly.
It's a grim reminder to always read the contract, be wary of vendor lock-in, and understand that sometimes the biggest threats aren't technical, they're contractual and political.
Speaking of fighting back against bad actors, our next story is about a one-man campaign that's causing havoc for the EU's chat control bill.
This is a fantastic David and Goliath story. A 30-year-old software developer in Denmark named Joachim was so angry about the EU's plan to mandate scanning of private encrypted messages that he spent a weekend building a website called fightchatcontrol.eu.
The site is brilliantly simple. It lets anyone easily compile a mass email protesting the bill and send it to a long list of MEPs and other national government officials. Since he launched it, the site has reportedly triggered several million emails, completely overwhelming the inboxes of policymakers.
And it's having a real effect. The article in Politico says that some EU member countries are now getting hesitant to support the bill, and there's a clear link to this campaign. The Polish government even issued a public statement responding directly to the email campaign.
My favorite part is the reaction from some of the politicians. Lena DuPont, a German MEP, is quoted saying, "In terms of dialogue within a democracy, this is not a dialogue."
The Hacker News comments had a field day with that quote. As one user put it, "It is a dialogue. Millions are against it. A few powerful people are in favor. The powerful are too detached from reality and consider this not a dialogue.
Another pointed out that when a regular person sends a carefully written letter, it just gets tallied as one for or against vote anyway. So a mass email is a perfectly appropriate response.
Someone else made the excellent point that this flood of emails gives the politicians a small taste of what police and other agencies would face if this bill passed. A daily deluge of millions of false positive flags from the scanning systems.
It's just a perfect example of effective grassroots digital activism. This one person with a simple website has managed to elevate the debate and put real pressure on lawmakers in a way that traditional lobbying often fails to do. It's a bit of faith in democracy restored.
And it all comes back to that core principle that if you give a government the power to do something, even as a last resort, that power will eventually be abused.
All right, for our final story, let's switch gears to some science. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry for 2025 has been awarded to Susumu Kitagawa, Richard Robson, and Omar M. Yagi.
They won for their pioneering work on a new class of materials called metal organic frameworks, or MOFs. The popular science description on the Nobel site is fantastic. It basically describes them as molecular architecture. They're like sponges, but on a whole other level.
Right. They are incredibly porous, crystalline structures with an enormous internal surface area. A commenter named Owen Versteeg put it in context. The previous gold standard for porous materials was something called zeolites, which have a surface area of maybe a few hundred square meters per gram. MOFs can have surface areas up to 7,000 square meters per gram. It's a massive leap forward.
And what's so cool about them is that they are rationally designed. Chemists can build them with specific properties to do specific jobs. The potential applications are mind-blowing. Harvesting water directly from desert air, capturing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, filtering pollutants out of water, or delivering drugs to specific parts of the body.
The origin story is also really inspiring. It started back in the 1970s with Richard Robson, one of the laureates. He was preparing a chemistry lesson using those old wooden ball and stick models of molecules. And while playing with them, he had an aha moment. What if he could use the inherent properties of atoms and molecules to build much larger, ordered structures with cavities inside?
The comments section loved that detail. It reminded people of the famous Richard Feynman story about how he got out of a creative slump by just playing around and figuring out the physics of a wobbling plate he saw in a cafeteria. That seemingly useless bit of play ended up being crucial for his Nobel-winning work later. It's a great testament to the value of curiosity-driven research.
And another commenter, Isopropoflex, shared a story about being an intern 15 years ago and making some of these MOFs in a lab. He said everyone's minds were just blown by the ridiculously huge surface areas they were measuring. So this isn't brand new, but it's a field that has been building for decades and is now being recognized for its world-changing potential. Congratulations to the laureates.
A very well-deserved prize.
And that's all the time we have for today. We covered Synology's big reversal, a deep compiler bug hunt at Cloudflare, a vendor horror story, a successful one-man activism campaign, and the Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
Thanks for tuning in to HN Pod. We'll be back tomorrow with more top stories from Hacker News.